morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Friday, February 3rd, 2006. I'm Chris Andre.
I'm Jim Thompson.
Coming up on the Morning News, the drive for repealing public financing in Oregon is financed by those who spend most of the money in elections. The White House seeks an extra $70 billion for operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, and an oil tanker carrying more than 100,000 barrels of oil has run aground in Alaska. Today's Portland area weather, today cloudy with patchy fog early, chance of rain early, then rain likely by noon, highs 50 to 55. Tonight, rain, lows around 45.
The Portland Opera Plaza already deals in theater. Next door, the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry holds a longtime big pipe sewer exhibit anchored by an imitation toilet. Now comes the real thing, the biggest production of all, the next stage of the $1.4 billion big pipe project to control sewer overflows. Starting within a month and continuing 6 years, the backyards of these two cultural attractions will serve as staging grounds for this final but largest big pipe phase, tunneling 6 miles under the Willamette River's east bank. Workers will dig a 115-foot open-air shaft, about the width of a softball diamond, into the Opera Plaza's paved parking lot. The plaza holds the opera bosses and its box office. Construction of the shaft will happen near the East Riverfront at Southwest Carruthers Street and Water Avenue. Opera spokesman Jim Fullman says the opera will encourage patrons to avoid the expected construction commotion by purchasing tickets by phone or online. This from the Oregonian.
Portland attorney Ron Saxton has surpassed the $1 million mark in fundraising for the governor's race. According to the Salem Statesman Journal, it's a sign that he can give better-known rival Kevin Mannix a serious run in the May Republican primary. State political candidates haven't filed campaign finance reports since September and don't have to file again until April, so it's difficult to assess their fundraising success until the primary approaches. But Saxton shares a spreadsheet of his donor list to buttress claims that he's leading the pack in the race for cash. Saxton's fundraising prowess helps make him a viable candidate. Democratic political consultant Mark Weiner said, "It shows me you have a very interesting and very competitive race on the Republican side." Saxton is a founding partner of the high-profile Ader Wynn law firm, a major underwriter of OPB. Saxton is raising hefty sums from a large number of Portland corporate chieftains, timber industry leaders, and real estate executives. Although Saxton is tagged as a moderate Republican, his nearly 900 donors include many prominent conservatives. He's collected more than 20 donations of $10,000 or more, topped by $100,000 each from his finance committee chairman, former Ambassador William Swindles, and Gerald Wynn executive Roderick Wendt.
Deschutes County Commissioners voted 2-1 Wednesday to approve a conceptual master plan for the $160 million Thornburg Resort west of Eagle Crest. One board member expressed concerns that some access and other issues were not fully resolved. Commissioner Mike Daly and Bev Clarno said they felt confident remaining issues can be dealt with before backers of the controversial resort file their more specific final master plan. But Commissioner Dennis Luke said he believed too much was still up in the air to endorse the plans. Wednesday was the self-imposed deadline commissioners set to decide the plans for the proposed 1,900-acre resort west of Redmond. The development includes 950 homes, a luxury hotel, and three 18-hole golf courses. A hearings officer had rejected the plans last fall, claiming the resort failed to ensure it would have adequate water as well as protect open space. All three commissioners agreed that the hearings officer had erred in rejecting their proposal for lack of water mitigation credits being in hand. They said the developers only needed to show the credits were feasible at the early stage of the process. After the decision, land use attorney Paul Dewey, representing opponent Nunzi Gould, agreed with Luke and said an appeal of the decision is likely to the State Land Use Board of Appeals. But resort developer Cameron Delaschmut and his lawyer, Miles Conway, said they believe quite the opposite. They have been held to a higher standard than past resort developments.
The committee trying to repeal public campaign financing in Portland is getting most of its money from those who tend to spend the most in elections. The First Things First Committee has spent nearly $350,000 collecting the signatures to put a repeal of the funding plan on the May ballot. The repeal organizers raised almost $200,000 from more than 80 donors and still owe $158,000 in accounts payable and nearly $10,000 in loans, according to a campaign finance report filed Wednesday. The Portland Business Alliance was the group's biggest contributor, chipping in $32,000 from its Political Action Committee. Among other big donors, Quest and Portland General Electric gave $10,000 each, and the Oregon Restaurant Association paid $10,500, giving at least $5,000 each for Northwest Natural Gas, Comcast, Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield, Schnetzer Investments, and the development team of Homer Williams and the Dame. The Taxpayers Association of Oregon offered more than $10,000 in direct mail help. The city council voted last year to give political candidates the money that they would need to run their campaigns if they agreed to limit spending. Candidates in city council races, for example, can receive $150,000 in the primary if they collect $5 contributions from 1,000 Portlanders. Proponents say the system will reduce the influence that big money plays in city government, but opponents say the city has better uses for the money. Janice Thompson, executive director of the Money and Politics Research Action Project, which keeps a database of campaign spending, estimates that the donors who contributed to the repeal, their family members or their co-workers, gave almost $500,000 of the more than $3 million city hall candidates raised in 2004.
A northern Idaho Indian tribe fears the state's plan to kill up to 75% of wolves in the Clearwater Basin to help the region's elk may hurt attempts to delist the predators from federal protections. Rebecca Miles is the chairwoman of the Nez Perce Indian tribe. She says the plan is controversial and could influence the direction of future wolf management in the state. There are many causes for low elk numbers in the region, including poor habitat. Miles says if habitat concerns aren't addressed, killing wolves may not be effective in restoring the herds. The tribe wants management decisions for wolves to be grounded in sound biology. Otherwise, Miles says, the credibility of wolf managers with the public will come into question.
House Republicans chose John Boehner to be their new majority leader. In so doing, they rejected a member of Tom DeLay's leadership team and resurrected a fallen Newt Gingrich lieutenant. Boehner's surprise victory over Roy Blunt completes an extraordinary political comeback for the collegial, heavy-smoking, and richly tanned Ohioan. 8 years ago, he lost his position as chairman of the House Republican Conference as his patron Gingrich fell from the speakership. But as chairman of the House Education Committee, Boehner regained favor among his colleagues and made his move when DeLay was forced to abandon the majority leadership. Though long a Gingrich acolyte, Boehner was suspected of having a role in the failed 1997 GOP coup against him. The next year, Boehner, who clashed with then-majority whip DeLay, lost his conference chairman job. But Boehner plotted a comeback, winning over his colleagues in part by his energetic fundraising. His Political Action Committee gave Republicans nearly $3 million since 1996. In 2001, a rehabilitated Boehner was given the chairmanship of the Education and Workforce Committee. This from the Washington Post.
According to the Chicago Tribune, the White House said yesterday that it will ask Congress to approve $70 billion in additional spending on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan through 2006. This brings the figure to nearly $400 billion by the end of the budget in September. In addition, President Bush will request a placeholding $50 billion for the wars in the new 2007 spending plan that the White House will unveil Monday. But like the $50 billion that the White House initially included for war in this year's budget, the Office of Management and Budget maintains that the real cost for 2007, dictated by, quote, events on the ground, is impossible to forecast. The request for more money came on a day when Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld warned against underestimating the global terrorist threat. Currently, the Defense Department maintains it is spending about $4.5 billion a month on the conflict in Iraq, or that's about $100,000 per minute. Current spending in Afghanistan is about $800 million a month, or about $18,000 per minute. The cost of the war in Iraq is clearly surpassing anyone's early estimates, including those of the administration.
A short-term extension of the Patriot Act passed the House, and the Senate is expected to follow suit. Senators of both parties have insisted on increased safeguards for civil liberties, and more time is needed for negotiations. Activists in Oregon are hoping for increased civic involvement. KBOO's Stephanie Potter has more.
After 9/11, the Bush administration pressed Congress to pass the Patriot Act, claiming that it was needed to keep Americans safe. Critics, however, have perceived it as part of a push to expand the powers of the executive branch and a threat to our basic liberties, for instance, authorizing investigations of bank accounts and computer searches.
There were a number of provisions that had sunset clauses in the original Patriot Act. Among those were the sneak and peek search authority, which can apply to any search, not just searches related to terrorists. There are two provisions directly related to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, that relate to the so-called library records provision and Section 218, which is the wiretap provision.
That was David Friedanke, executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. He says Bush has been pressing to have all of the Patriot Act made permanent, and most of it has, but 16 of the provisions were set to expire. A new provision included in the Patriot Act by Senator Arlen Specter would give the Secret Service authority to make felony arrests of demonstrators as special events considered to be nationally significant. Hope Marston of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee has concerns.
There are things that will clamp down on people who are just exercising their freedom of speech at presidential political events.
Last year, Marston worked to have a bill introduced to the Oregon legislature that would have, among other things, prohibited state employees from participating in search and seizure techniques that violated the state constitution.
And the essence of it was to uphold the Oregon Constitution in every way. The Oregon Constitution, I don't know if you're that familiar with it. I don't think I was all that familiar with it until we started studying it. And it is a lot more protective of our Bill of Rights than even the U.S. Constitution.
The bill died in committee last August when the legislature ended. David Friedanke again.
We wanted to follow up on a bill that had been passed by the Oregon Senate back in 2003 that called on Congress to revise, reform the Patriot Act. And, you know, we ran into a partisan brick wall, basically, in both the House and Senate.
Numerous communities throughout Oregon have demonstrated opposition to the Patriot Act.
For a local perspective, I can tell you that we've had 14 resolutions against the Patriot Act passed in Oregon. Ashland, Astoria, Benton County, Coos County, Corvallis, Douglas County, Eugene, Gaston, Lane County, Multnomah County, Port Orford, Portland, Talent, Wheeler. This state has taken a stand against the Patriot Act.
Friedanke says that in Congress, originally only three Oregon representatives opposed the act, but that's changed.
Fast forward to December of 2005, all of the House Democrats, including Darlene Hooley, voted against extension of the Patriot Act.
And Senator Wyden, who had voted for the Patriot Act in 2001, now calls it skewed. Last December, he provided a key vote to filibuster it.
Which is why the conference report got deadlocked in the Senate and why the issue is still deadlocked.
David Friedanke of the ACLU of Oregon. Over the next month or so, there will be opportunities to push for reforms in the Patriot Act.
There still is a lot of chance for people in the state of Oregon to work to influence Congress. If we can work now in this period of time when Bush is on the defensive about the National Security Agency spying, if we can put pressure on Congress to make a difference in Congress, I think that's where we need to focus our attention.
Hope Marston of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
A series of tornadoes blew through storm-weary New Orleans yesterday, causing damage in areas still recovering from Hurricane Katrina 5 months ago. Police Department spokesman Juan Barnes said at least seven flood-damaged homes in the Lakeview area, hit hard by Katrina, had been knocked down by a twister that had fallen trees and utility poles had blocked streets and tied up traffic. At the city's Louis Armstrong International Airport, windows were smashed, a temporary roof torn off, and passenger boarding ramps damaged. Power was off until midday, forcing some flights to be canceled and others delayed. Airport spokesman Michelle Dufourcq said the storm did an estimated $2 million in damage. The tornadoes were touched off by a line of thunderstorms that woke up residents with deafening thunder and flashes of lightning. U.S. National Weather Service meteorologist Paul Trotter said people in New Orleans, after the death and destruction caused by Katrina, are wary of powerful storms. This according to Reuters.
Persistent protesters from a Kansas church wouldn't be welcome at Kentucky funerals under a bill called out of a state Senate committee yesterday. The legislation itself will be the target of yet another protest by Westboro Baptist Church of Topeka, Kansas. Members of that church calling Kentucky legislators demagogues masquerading as statesmen say they will be at the Capitol on February 8th. They've also planned to protest the same day at a memorial for Port Campbell soldiers killed in Iraq. The Kansas group routinely protests U.S. soldiers' funerals across the country, carrying signs such as, "Thank God for IEDs," the improvised explosive devices used by insurgents. Members also went to West Virginia to protest the funerals of dead coal miners last month. The group, largely the extended family of the Reverend Fred Phelps, sees the deaths as a sign of God punishing America for tolerating gays. In Illinois, a legislative committee advanced a bill last week that would bar protests within 200 feet during services and 30 minutes before and after them. Lawmakers in 14 other states are considering legislation that would limit the protests at funerals. Some of the bills would require protesters to stay a specified distance away from the funerals or funeral processions.
An oil tanker has run aground at a port in Alaska, according to the BBC. The Seabulk Pride broke free from moorings while being loaded in Nikiski, southwest of Anchorage, and ran aground on silt. The double-hulled tanker was carrying more than 100,000 barrels of different oil products. The Coast Guard says some oil has leaked into the sea. An oil spill from the Exxon Valdez in Alaska in 1989 devastated wildlife and took 4 years to clean up. A spokesman for the Tesoro Refinery, which had chartered the vessel, said the Seabulk Pride broke free after being hit by an ice floe. Alaskan Environmental Protection authorities have sent a helicopter and tugboats to the area to assess how much oil has been spilled.
Directors of the National Intelligence, John Negroponte, testified today in front of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence to present an annual assessment of national threats. He stressed that the globalization of technologies and the emergence of transnational networks complicates intelligence gathering and makes the surveillance of international phone calls absolutely necessary. Anastasia Gnidetskaya reports from Washington, D.C.
Director of National Intelligence John Negroponte testified today in front of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence to present an annual assessment of national threats. He stressed that the globalization of technologies and the emergence of transnational networks complicates intelligence gathering and makes the surveillance of international phone calls absolutely necessary. Anastasia Netstitska reports from Washington, D.C.
During today's testimony, John Negroponte listed major threats to U.S. security, such as spread of WMDs, pandemics, narcotics trafficking, and international terrorist networks. He said that these threats are aggravated by globalization and make for a special need to control the countries that do not cooperate.
We need to work hand in hand with other responsible nations. Fortunately, the vast majority of governments in the world are responsible and responsive. But those that are not are neither few in numbers nor lacking in material resources and geopolitical influence.
One question and answer session called into question the motivation behind holding closed sessions, particularly with regard to Al-Qaeda's communications. Senator Levin from Michigan questions Deputy Director for National Intelligence General Hayden.
Can you give us an estimate as to the number of such communications which were tracked by NSA last year? Just an estimate.
Can't do that.
Sorry. I'd be very uncomfortable doing it in open session, and I don't actually know that number.
I think it is a denial. Basically, the administration wants to be unchecked, either by a court or by the Congress.
Another unanswered question was asked by Senator Feingold from Wisconsin.
Can you assure us today that there are not other intelligence collection, and I emphasize collection programs,
that you are aware of and that you are keeping from the full Intelligence Committee?
Senator, I don't know if I can comment on that in an open session.
Senate Judiciary Committee will hold a series of hearings next week to question Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez concerning the legality of a domestic eavesdropping program. Other issue on the agenda will be how intelligence agencies are dealing with the information thus obtained. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnezditska in Washington, D.C.
There is a website where an interested person can register a subject's cell phone number and then track the movements of that individual. There is no trace of what is happening on the target's cell phone. The police and telecommunications companies can do this, but not just anyone with 5 minutes access to somebody's phone. Or maybe they can. As devious systems go, it's foolproof. The website can be set to track the subject at regular intervals, take a snapshot of their whereabouts automatically every half hour, and plot their path on the map. The UK's Guardian newspaper suggests that if you have any reason to suspect that your phone might have been out of your sight even for 5 minutes, and there is someone who might want to track you, call your phone company and ask to find out if there is a trace on your phone.
Protests against European newspapers' publication of cartoons lampooning the Prophet Muhammad gained momentum across the Islamic world yesterday. Pakistani schoolchildren burned French and Danish flags, and Muslim presidents denounced the drawings. At the same time, more European news organizations printed or broadcast the caricatures, citing a need to defend freedom of expression. In another day of confrontation between the largely secular nations of Europe and Muslim countries, Islamic activists threatened more widespread protests and boycotts of European businesses. While some European officials sought to defuse the crisis, many journalists insisted that, despite Islamic outrage, religious sensibilities should not result in censorship. Under Islamic teachings, any depiction of Muhammad, the faith's founder and messenger of God, is blasphemy, including depictions that are not negative. The cartoons violated that dictum, and many of them also ridiculed the prophet. In one, he is depicted as a terrorist with a turban holding a bomb with burning fuse. Political analysts from both sides described the newspaper's printing of the cartoons as a dangerous incitement in a conflict that has already alienated the growing Muslim populations of Western European nations and hardened extremists in both camps. This from the Washington Post.
Tony Blair told President George Bush that he was solidly behind U.S. plans to invade Iraq before he sought advice about the invasion's legality and despite the absence of a second U.N. resolution. According to a new account of the build-up to the war, published today, in a two-hour meeting between the two leaders at the White House, Bush made it clear the U.S. intended to invade. The memo shows that war would be declared whether or not there was a second U.N. resolution, and even if U.N. inspectors found no evidence of banned Iraqi weapons program. The disclosures came in a new edition of Lawless World by Philippe Sands. Professor Sands last year exposed the doubts shared by Foreign Office lawyers about the legality of the invasion in disclosures which eventually forced the Prime Minister to publish the full legal advice given to him by Attorney General Lord Goldsmith. On March 7, 2003, Goldsmith advised the Prime Minister that the Bush administration believed that a case could be made for an invasion without a second UN resolution. But he warned that Britain would be challenged in the International Criminal Court. 10 days later, he said a second resolution was not necessary.
U.S. Intelligence Chief John Negroponte said yesterday the United States does not believe Iran has a nuclear weapon, but the danger Tehran will acquire one is an immediate concern. This according to The Guardian, to Reuters. Negroponte also told a Senate committee looking into the range of threats to the United States that Al-Qaeda was still plotting and preparing for attacks on the U.S. The committee was looking up the proliferation threat posed by Iran on the same day the International Atomic Energy Agency considered whether to report the Islamic Republic to the U.N. Security Council over its nuclear program. Iran insists its nuclear ambitions are purely to develop power. Negroponte also said that while much of Al-Qaeda's leadership from the time of the September 11th attacks on the United States had been eliminated, its quote, core elements still plot and make preparations for terrorist strikes against the homeland and other targets from bases in the Pakistan-Afghanistan border area, unquote. An attack using conventional explosives remains the most probable scenario, but Al-Qaeda remains interested in acquiring chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear materials or weapons, said Negroponte. He said, attacking U.S. territory, U.S. interests abroad, and allies overseas remained Al-Qaeda's top priorities. Negroponte added that nearly 40 terrorist organizations, insurgencies, cults, and other groups have used, possessed, or expressed an interest in chemical, biological, or nuclear agents or weapons.
The UN's atomic watchdog will refer Iran to the Security Council when it meets to discuss Tehran's nuclear program today, according to the BBC. Russia has reportedly decided to support sending Iran to the Council as long as the threat of sanctions is withheld for at least another month. The U.S. and EU are backing a motion for Iran's referral, which, they say, still leaves room for diplomacy. Iran warns it will accelerate its nuclear work if it is referred. Iran's top nuclear negotiator, Ali Larijani, said on Thursday that Tehran would stop allowing UN inspections and resume peaceful nuclear activities without restriction if Iran is sent to the Security Council, which can impose sanctions. Iran recently decided to resume suspended research on uranium enrichment. Iran maintains its program is for producing energy and does not have a military aim. The 35-member board of the UN watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, reconvenes this afternoon in Vienna to decide whether to refer Iran to the Security Council.
And finally, at an August 2004 demonstration at New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg's residence, demonstrators arrived angry, departed furious. The police had herded them into pens, stopped them from handing out flyers, threatened them with arrest for standing on public sidewalks, and made notes on which politicians they cheered and which ones they razzed. In a deposition, one of the demonstrators, Walter Liddy, said, "That's Big Brother watching you." Liddy's complaint about police tactics, while hardly novel from a big city protester, stands out because of his job. Liddy is a New York City police officer. The rallies he attended were organized in the summer of 2004 by his union, the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, to protest the pace of contract talks with the city. Now the officers are suing New York, charging that the police procedures at their demonstrations, many of them routinely used as at war protests, anti-poverty marches, and mass bike rides, were so heavy-handed and intimidating that their First Amendment rights were violated. A lawyer for the city said the police union members were treated no differently than hundreds of thousands of people at other gatherings, with public safety and free speech both protected. The city maintains that the department observes all constitutional requirements.
And that was the KBOO Morning News for Friday, February 3rd, 2006. Portland area weather. Today, cloudy with patchy fog early, chance of rain early, then rain likely by noon, highs 50 to 55. Tonight, rain, lows around 45. Saturday, showers, chance of thunderstorms, windy, highs 45 to 50. Saturday night, showers likely and colder. Sunday, mostly cloudy. Chance of showers in the morning, highs 45 to 50. And Sunday night, partly cloudy with areas of fog, lows around 35. Thanks for joining us this morning's news. This morning's newscast was edited by Becca Bartleson and Chris Andre. And Becca is engineering right now. KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Chris Andre.
I'm Chris Andre.
Oh, I'm Jim Thompson. We got confused. At 7:30, Ani and Melody host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. The guest is Daryl Hunt, who spent 20 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. His experience is told in the new film, The Trials of Daryl Hunt. At 9, it's APA Compass with the topic, I Love Orientals, Cultural Appreciation or Theft. At 10, hear guests from Body Talk, a system of improved communication and synchronization within and between all the elements of the body and mind for better health. 10:30 on Sounds of Awareness, Lisa Lieberman, author of A Stranger Among Us, talks about in-home support for children with autism or spectrum disorder. 11, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodwin. And stay tuned for the KBOO Evening News at 5 p.m. Would you like to help with the morning news? KBOO needs volunteers to help getting important stories like these out to listeners like you. Please contact us at amnews@kboo.org or call 503-231-8032, extension 202. This is KBOO, your community radio station, in Portland, 90.7 FM. In Corvallis, on translator K264AA at 107 megahertz. And K220HR in Hood River at 91.9 FM. Have a lovely weekend.
This is the KBOO Community Calendar for Friday, February 3rd. One can see the second annual Portland International Nature and Environmental Film Festival at selected places throughout Portland, February 3rd and 4th. The Pine Film screens newly released and critically acclaimed films on themes of sustainability, culture, and social justice, emphasizing the interconnection of people to people and people to place. Produced by Livable Place, a Portland-based nonprofit, the films are selected to entertain and engage while empowering audience to make a difference. For more information and schedule times, visit www.pinefilms.org or www.livableplace.org. At the Fort Vancouver National Historic Site, park staff will initiate evening Latin tours for the first time at the site. These ranger-led tours will take visitors through the reconstructed Hudson Bay Company Fort by candlelight. This will run Friday, February 3rd at 7 p.m. through Saturday, February 18th till 7 p.m. For more info, call 360-696-7659, extension 14. Admission is $3 per person. The Oregon Seafood and Wine Festival is a celebration all things Oregon, but most specifically our wonderful Oregon seafood and wines. There will be 52 wineries, 15 restaurants, and a martini bar and more. All 90,000 square feet of food and beverages are found under one roof at the Oregon Convention Center on 777 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. This festival will run Friday, February 3rd, 3 to 10 p.m., and Saturday, February 4th, 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. $10 will get you in, open to all ages. For more info, call 360-210-5275. Strummin' Full Chillin' is a benefit concert series, which all proceeds from this showcase of songwriters goes toward Morrison Family and Child Services to help women and children who have come from abusive situations. The lineup for this evening will feature the Tracy Claus, Jeremy Sower, Miguel Artu, and Alan Bennett. The theme for the night will be songs of love, understanding, pain, and healing. $5 suggested donation. This will be at the Bitter Inn Pub on Northwest 19th and Burnside, across from Blockbuster. Tonight, the 3rd at 8 p.m. You may contact 503-289-0624. For any more information, go to www.morrisonkids.org. One can see Oil on Ice, a documentary connecting the fate of the Arctic National Wildlife refugees to decision American makes about the energy policy, transportation choices, and other seemingly unrelated matters. Caught in the balance are the culture and livelihood of the Gwich'in, Athabascan Indians, and the Inuit Eskimos, and the migratory wildlife in this fragile ecosystem. There will be a $5 suggested donation. No one will be turned down. Show is at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church at 1011 Southwest 12th. For more info, contact Barbara Ford at 503-282-0740. That was the KBOO Community Calendar for Friday, February 3rd.